So Jainism is an ancient religion from India. As Dalai Lama puts in his book, Jainism, sibling of Buddhism, because both Jainism and Buddhism has the same roots of what we call Shramana tradition of India, spiritual tradition of India. In ancient times, 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, India had two different philosophies. One was the Vedic, which has become what we now call Hinduism, and other was Shramana tradition. And those two, the Shramana tradition evolved into two, Jainism and Buddhism. Shramanas believe, the rishis or Shramanas believe in self-effort. They said that your enlightenment, your emancipation can only happen through self-effort, not by the grace of somebody, the gods. And you can liberate yourself. You can become, if we want to call it, God. That you can become God, because not just an image of God, not just be with God, be the God. And so they say we can, each one of us has the potential and capacity to do that. So anyways, both of them, because we have the roots in the same Shramana tradition, the most of the principles are similar. As Buddha has said himself, he, instead of very hard ascetic life of Jains, he chose a path of middle path. And that's why he calls it is a middle path. That it, at all, this level of asceticism is not necessary. And which, of course, makes it easier for people to follow, because ours is a pretty rigorous asceticism. Anyway, so just to say that Buddhism and Jainism has similar roots. Popular myth that the Orientalists from Europe created was, Mahavir was the founder of Jainism. Whereas we say, no, Mahavir was not the founder of Buddhism. He was the reviver of Buddhism. He was the 24th spiritual leader, or as we call Tirthankara, of Jainism, than there were before, 23 before him. So the tradition itself has been revived and revived and revived by each of the spiritual leaders of his time. Historically, of course, everyone agrees that Mahavira existed and Mahavir lived on this world, or existed in this world. The historians now agree that 23rd Tirthankara, which is Parshvanath, about 250 years before Mahavir, also existed and roamed the lands of India. So at least they have accepted that 23rd is a real person. There is question of 22nd and 21st, and 22nd is about the time of Mahabharata, 21st is the time of Indus Valley Civilization. So Indus Valley Civilization is anywhere from 3500 to 5000 BC. And so the roots can, as the evidence mounts, roots can go backwards historically. But historians have accepted both the 24th and the 23rd. And actually the Buddhist canons talk about Nirgranthas, as they were called then. They were not called Jain. Jain is a very late edition used word Jainism or Jain. But in the time of Mahavir, they were called Nirgranthas, and also in the time of Parshvanath, and Buddhist canons do talk about Nirgranthas.
Nirgranthas.
Not it. Nirgranthas that have no knots anywhere, they're not attached to anything. And so that's where they were known. And there is quite a bit of description of Jain philosophy in Buddhist canons. Similarly, in our canon, there is about the various spiritual traditions that existed at the time in India. Also, at the time of India, 3,000 years ago, it was not an established religion. In fact, India probably does not have an established religion as we know in the Western world. You know, to call in Jainism and Buddhism a religion is a little bit of misnomer, because we don't have the same concept as it's a Christianity, Islam, you know, and Judaism. It's a way of life. It's the way of spiritual enlightenment. It's the way of ultimate emancipation, or nirvana, or moksha, as we call it. And it's a path shown by those who have achieved it, saying, this is how I achieved it. Even they could not make you emancipation or enlightenment. It's your self-effort. You have to practice. You have to adapt and practice. Only then there is no grace. You can't say tathastu in Hinduism, and you are forgiven. No, you have to pay for your sins. So it's a very much of self-effort. And of course, the history is slowly going forward. The Jainism has four pillars of its, you know, structure. We call Sangha, as you call Sangha. And there is two, which is the ascetics, the male ascetic and female ascetic. And there is a male lay person and female lay person. But the lay person is not just an ordinary human. You know, just somebody practicing Jainism does not mean he is a lay shravak, as we call them. But if he adapts the vows and he follows the vows, then he is a shravak, he is a Jain lay person. There's the four pillars, and they are, the Jain Sangha belongs to all four Sanghas, and they have equal. Important thing to see is that both male and female, both in ascetic as well as in lay, votary as they call them, are equal. They are both equal. Spiritually, they both can achieve. And there is no difference between male or female. Because we believe in reincarnations. As we go through, in reincarnations, you could be male this life and female next life. You could be animal next life and come back as human again. Because the soul has no sex. Soul that evolves and retakes birth after birth has no sex. It adapts to different bodies. Depending upon its karma and load of karma, it will either get a female body or male body in different life forms. And hence, we believe everybody is equal, every soul is equal. It has the same capacity of enlightenment, same capacity of power to achieve. Of course, it is covered today as embodied soul. We are covered with karma, and that karma defilation is what gives you different life and gives you different bodies. And of course, you can be born as animals, vegetables, you know, or we will believe that there is heavenly bodies. You know, celestial beings and hell beings, because we believe in there is a hell and there is heaven. But again, that is no different than human. It just happens to be where those life forms, you have different characteristics. Heavenly life is pleasure, 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 and you're able to change your body, you're able to manipulate your body into anything and everything you want to, whereas in hell, you are paying for your sins, and of course you have nothing but suffering, suffering, suffering for that life period until you have reduced the load of karma to where you can take a rebirth of course, your yes. So anyway, just to say about locally, as you mentioned, we have a Jain center here, or Jain temple in Milpitas. We built that and opened that thing in 2000. Our Sangh itself, or the Jain society, or center as we call it, was started in 1981 here in Bay Area. Earliest one is in 70s in East Coast. And then we also have a federation of Jain associations in North America, which has most of this, all of the centers belong to, which is an umbrella organization. But it is much more for coordination, not as a governing body. It is much more coordination of activities, coordination of programs, and we do conduct national convention every 2 years. And we have our youth, what we call our youth wing, Young Giants of America. They conduct their conventions every 2 years, alternate years. So we do it in odd years and they do it in even years. They come together. That young people's convention is run by them, for them, and organized by them. So they are a young youth wing of China, but they operate almost autonomously. So I extend my invitation for all of you to visit the Jain temple in Milpitas. And through Bhagyat, you can let me know. Then I can arrange for your visit. Or if you want to come as a group, we'll welcome you there, give you a tour of the temple. And of course, nobody comes to our temple and not get food. So you'll be so
vegetarian.
That's our hospitality.
Vegetarian.
Vegetarian, of course. Of course.
When they asked me what was the difference between Jainism and Buddhism, I had a hard time. And I said, but they are more strict with not killing animals.
We are.
Right?
We are very strict, not only killing animals, killing anything that is life. And increasingly, we are promoting veganism. And because even the way we have the dairy industry now has so much harm, so much suffering that it inflicts on the cows, that we say that kind of harming is not just killing, it's non-violence, as we call it. And unfortunately, the word non-violence is not a appropriate translation of ahimsa.
Oh.
Because ahimsa is ahimsa, which is not harming, not killing. When you put into non-violence, it almost becomes a word as physical violence. Because violence is associated mostly with physical violence, whereas ahimsa is actually mental, speech, verbal, and bodily. Because all of the violence starts right here in our mind. First it is a thought, then is a verbal expression sometimes, and once, you know, verbal expression, even if you don't speak out, it's a verbal expression in your anger, and then it is physical action. And that the Jains believe that mental harming or mental violence is as much harmful to you as soul as the physical violence. And the second example we give is doctor kills you, cuts you up and all that, and he dies, you know, especially sometimes patients die. He doesn't get a charge of murder. And similarly, he doesn't get the karma of killing because it was not his intention. His intention was noble. He was trying to save you. He was trying to cure you. But he got killed, you know, because things didn't go as well. So it's a question is really the mental attitude. What is it your thought? If you are thinking about killing someone and actually you kill it in your mind, you have committed a murder from karma point of view. And so the three major principles of Jainism is non-violence. Before I go there, I just say we believe that the universe is eternal, that everything exists to eternity. The soul is eternal. It is in different form, either it is embodied form like we are, because it is of covered with karma, and that's why it gets embodied form. Or when it liberates, or when it achieves nirvana or moksha, it is in pure form, but it is an existing soul, exists and remains forever, which is the difference between Buddhism and Jainism, that it's all gone, it's not. That Jainism believes you are individual and you remain individual even though at in the place where you go after you become emancipated, liberated, is the soul's, it's a sort of field. And a soul is a field and they can be intermingled and they can be, you know, occupy the space together at the same space. But it is still individual, remains individual, and it is eternal. Everything is eternal, including all the matter. It keeps changing forms, from one form to other. You know, plant becomes, becomes a plant, and then it disintegrates and disintegrates into something else. Our body disintegrates. Every part of our body, which is not in life itself, it's not soul, it's not consciousness, itself remains. It's not created, not destroyed. So everything is eternal in life. Soul in its pure form has infinite knowledge, complete perception or vision, permanent bliss, and infinite energy. And those are the qualities of God. So, in that sense, when you have that, you are like godliness. But the difference between the God and our state of liberation, liberated state, is that in the liberated state, you have no desire. The soul has no desire in liberated states. So it's not going to come and help you, because to help you has to have desire. It's in pure state of bliss. And because it's in pure state of bliss, you are oblivious to everything around you, because you don't get involved into it. You may see it and you are just observing it, but you are not going to ever get involved into it. And that's why there is no grace. So souls, liberated souls, don't come back and say, okay, I'll liberate you all guys. I'll liberate you all guys. I tell you exactly how to do it.
No bodhisattva. Huh? No bodhisattva.
No bodhisattva. Anyway, but in emancipated state where, what we call kevajna, in that state, it is still embodied. And you have the knowledge and you have destroyed four types of karma that inhibit the qualities of soul, you are able to then, sermons and advise people and write, which are then written down as scriptures. So the Shankaras do speak, and they do it, give you all the advice as to how to achieve so the path. Same Buddha does, but in a pure state, you are not have any desire to do.
Could you serve without desire?
What is it?
Could you serve? Could you be of service?
Well, at the liberated state, you have absolutely no desire to serve. Is only in the embodied state, but emancipated state, enlightened state, where you can, because you have achieved that level of karma that says, I will impart the knowledge, I will impart the wisdom. It is your karma that says you are born to impart the wisdom. And Tirthankaras are born, they come with those kinds of good karmas, which says, that automatically the wisdom comes up and is constantly emanating from them, the wisdom. Again, it is, they have infinite karuna, because they have liberated, they have destroyed four types of karma that cover your energy, cover your wisdom, and hence they are imparting, and they have very, very much compassion towards every living that they see. And they will try to not help you in the sense of do something, but they will give you advice and give you, tell you how, show you the path, how you can go forward. So the three main tenets of Jainism, which of course are similar, non-violence or ahimsa. Other one is what we call an ekantvad or multiplicity of viewpoints. And third is aparigraha, which is non-possessiveness. So it says non-violence in English terms and non-absolutism and non-possessiveness. Those are the three principles that we, in non-violence, it includes harming, not just killing. So if I say bad words to you and I affect you, it is violence. Different levels of violence, but it is a violence. And it is you who will suffer for it. The person I am angry at, or person I am harming, may have a different level. If that person becomes angry, that person becomes hateful, that person reacts to it, then the person is creating his own karma. So karma is only what you do. I cannot change your karma. I cannot give you karma. Only you can collect your karma. If you don't react to my action, or you remain totally peaceful in a meditative state, you haven't increased your karma. Even when somebody kills you, if you remain in a total peaceful state, without any hatred, without any feeling of revenge, hatefulness, you have not increased your karma. I have increased my karma. Even though I killed you, I was not killed. But I killed you, or I hurt you. My karma is increased because of my action. I think it's similar to what you believe, right? And, but it's very important to know it's all level of killing. Now, one would say that, but how can we live without, that there's a life in everything. Life in plants, life in insects, life in, humans and all of them. Well, we do have to eat. We do have to maintain our body to make spiritual progress. But the level of karma that you get from food or what is necessities is much lower than the level of karma you would get, or the load of karma you get in premeditative actions. If I am eating food and I say, gee, this is so tasty, I really want to eat more of it. Now my karma load went up. Just eating because I need to maintain my body will give me that karma. And it's a kind of karma that will actually be removed, very easily from your soul. It just drops off. Every time you acquire karma, it has its own intensity, its own type of karma and category of karma and the length of which, before which it will automatically fall off. So it has its own life and it will fall off. So all your karmas will fall off except for those which are done premeditatively. And those who are done premeditatively, you will have to suffer similarly, for it to be fusioned out. And this. So that's why when you are eating, this is very hard, I want more of this. Now even eating vegetarian food, you will create enough karma, which will take fasting, which will take penance for you to get rid of, versus just a normal life. Even breathing, you are killing life in, because we believe there is life in air, life in water, life in fire. And it's not just they are fire, but there is, the, like the body we have, the soul itself can take birth in a fire body. It can take birth in air body. So it's not the insects and microorganisms that are in the air. It's that soul itself can be, can have that body of air. And so every time you breathe, you are killing them. Therefore, they have the life that is very short, and they take birth and die birth, and because we take infinite number of births. So that's a... there are two kinds of hints, which we call possessiveness, actually, which I'll come later. But there is mental as well as physical. And attachment is a mental form of hinsa. And we'll talk more about that as we go, because I don't want to get in. Anekanta is another principle which says that you cannot, see this reality. You cannot perceive the reality from any one perspective or from any one viewpoint. And because everything is changing. What you are today, you are not there tomorrow. What you are tomorrow, you are not there a few seconds later. And as you are evolving, you have to see from all different perspectives to understand the reality. All different viewpoints. Hence, we should not be, we can almost say truth cannot be spoken. Because to speak the truth, you will have to put it all the different perspective. And if you have to put all different perspective in one sentence, you will never be able to express it. So, that's why it says truth cannot be expressed or spoken, is because you cannot really speak all different perspective of that particular entity that you're viewing. Translated otherwise is that you have to be able to see anything you say, everything you say, or anybody says, there may be an element of truth from one perspective that could be a truth. And you have to be able to see. So, in practical life, non-absolutism means tolerance of views. Listen to others, and you have to have tolerance for it. You are wrong, I am right is wrong. itself is wrong, because you may be saying from your perspective it is truth. It's for me to understand your perspective so I can see your truth. At least your perception of the truth at the moment. And hence, it means, I call it non-violence of thought. So you have to practice, everything around involves around ahimsa. It's all everything. Actually, ahimsa itself starts from, the root of ahimsa is compassion. Compassion towards everything. Compassion towards life, compassion towards universe, compassion towards everything in your path. And if you feel that we are all souls of equal capacity, we have to have compassion for everyone that is around us, including a small insect, small ant, or even a micro. So, and how can we harm our brothers and sisters? Can we harm our brothers and sisters? Well, we are all brothers and sisters. Yeah, because we're not born in the same way as brothers and sisters are born, but we are still brothers and sisters. We are equals. So that's where the ahimsa itself comes from, is compassion towards everyone, every one of your friends, compassion towards everything. But so anyway, the ahimsa, anekantva, is non-violence of thought. And that gives, and Mahatma Gandhi, who took ahimsa from Jainism, understood the level of ahimsa from Jainism, and even Jain spiritual guru, Kavi Raichand, or Srimad Raichandra as we call him now, he had a lot of correspondence with him, and he understood the principles of non-violence and absolutism. not of absolutism. And he was more in use that in his creating a political movement to liberate India with his understanding. So he was always listening to British and turning around their own argument to say, but that is not right. Or how can it be right? You know, he was able to express it, but listen, very much saying, okay, so you, I understand your viewpoint. But let me tell you my viewpoint. And ultimately they had to agree to give freedom to India. He convinced everybody that was the right thing to do. And hence he was able to do the liberation of India without sword in his hand, which had not happened before. The third principle is aparigraha, non-possessiveness. Now this is ecology. Non-possessiveness is in a material form, it is ecology. Not to destroy anything that is around you. Not to consume anything more than you need. Because even if you consume more than you need, then you are committing violence or harm. The purpose of life is spiritual progress. Purpose of life is spiritual progress. Your ultimate goal is liberation from this cycle of birth and death, which we have taken infinite number of them for infinite amount of times. And hence, you want to consume as little as possible. There is two kinds of non-possessiveness. Of course, materially, you try to reduce your possessiveness, But more importantly, don't be attached to your possessions. This is my chair. This is not your chair. If it's your chair, it will come with you all the time. In life after life after life. It's not going to come with you. So it's not yours. My father, my mother, they're not mine. Yeah, in this birth, in this life, they gave me birth. They are not my mother or father forever. Maybe in the past life, my mother was my child and I was her father. Or in the past life, that dog over there was my grandfather. So look at it that way. Everything you look around, it was connected to you in the past. And it was connected to you in the past. You better respect that life form. And hence, is it's your mental possessiveness, because we attach to everything. This is mine, and only because of that we get angry, we get ego, and of course we deceive ourselves, actually deceive, as we call Maya. Krodh, man, Maya, anger, ego, deceit. Deceit is what? Deceit is self-deceiving. Deceit is not cheating you. Deceiving is not just make you fool out of yourself and take something from you. Deceiving is believing that what I am doing is right. That Maya is you cheating your own soul. Saying, no, this is okay. I can do this level of wrong things. That's where Maya comes in. But that comes from all this possessiveness. We call it attachment and aversion. Aversion is not as bad as attachment is. Think about it. Aversion, you are angry at somebody, you are jealous of somebody, and you want to take revenge. That is temporary. You're not going to be constantly there. It's not going to come, for a long time in your life forms. But attachment will give you, because with attachment we do all kinds of things that we should not do. And we call it rag, and rag is dangerous. Attachment is very dangerous for your spiritual progress. You're supposed to see and observe and not get attached to it. Even done good deeds done with attachment turns into good karma, not towards, you know, liberation. Because your good karma and bad karma are both bad for you. It is a pollution of your soul. It pollutes your soul. It's a karmic matter attached to your soul. It pollutes your soul. Hence, even the good karma that is going to give you good fusion, good results in the, when it, you know, fusion comes along. You may have a lot of wealth in next life or this life. You get very happiness. You get physical good body. You know, but it's still a defilement of the soul and does not take you, because you have to get rid of both the good karma and bad karma for to become pure. And if you are doing good karma, then you still have to get rid of that. And that's what becomes a problem, because while you are enjoying the fruit of a good karma, you could be collecting far more bad karma and increasing your lifestyle. So don't be happy, you know. I got so much money, you know. What to do about it? Give it away. Give it away. Anyway, so
here's, it's just about 9. Would you be willing to take a couple of questions?
Sure, absolutely. I think that, and anyway, just let me give you one more thing, okay?
Sure.
The code of conduct, I just want to mention five main vows that our ascetics take, and also the sravaks, or the, you know, lay persons take. Of course, in there are parallel, most of it with and the first vow is vow of not harming or ahimsa. Second vow is truth. You know, you speak truth, because if you speak truth, you can't be violent. If you constantly speak truth, you can't be violent. You can't be doing hinsa. Hinsa and truth don't go together. Third is what we call asteya, or non-stealing. Non-stealing is actually taking something that doesn't belong to you. So taking anything without the permission of the owner is asteya, is stealing. So if I take something that is lying around, if I take that is not rightfully mine, without the permission of the owner, then that is stealing. So non-stealing. Fourth is what we call celibacy. And it is celibacy at different levels. For the ascetic, it is absolute celibacy. No sexual, not only sexual act, but not sexual mental, you know, thoughts. No sensuousness. For the sravak, it is monogamy, meaning just with your spouse and not beyond. Thinking and, you know, sensuous thinking, and that is also, you know, when you take that vow, you are prohibited from enjoying. And the last, of course, is apoligro, possessiveness. There are more vows, but these are the five main vows. Ascetics will take it absolute level. They will not harm, they will not kill, you know. They don't cook. They don't have house to live in. They stay at our, you know, monasteries or our religious places. We actually don't have monasteries like Buddhists, you know, used to have. There are places where they go and stay, because they don't stay more than a few days at a time, except in the monsoon season for 4 months, you know, because they're not supposed to travel during the rainy season. So they stay at one place, and that's when they interact with the laypersons and impart a lot of sermons and help them become more spiritual. So these are the five, you know.
So ascetics are like monastics.
Sorry?
Ascetics are like monastics, like in the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Big monks and
monks. Right. I mean, Buddhists have adapted the word monk. And now Buddhist monks are known as Buddhist monks with, you know, orange robes or whatever. We have not adapted the word monk. Though some people will call our munis, you know, sadhus or muni, which is a male ascetic, and sadhvi, as female ascetic, monks and nuns, but none of those words come anywhere close to. Because, like, your monk has at least lives in the monastery or lives in a place, he has the facilities there, whereas our monk or ascetic carry things with them, what they can carry, and they have very little possessions of their own, or actually none. So there's a level of detachment that goes with it. But yes, you can call it, you know, so that's why they take these five main vows, and, you know, they, in fact, the meditative state, as we call it samayak, which is you can do a, where you are detached from everything around you, mentally. And the first vow that our sadhu and sadhvi say, he is the vow of lifetime samayi, or lifetime meditative state. That's the first vow they take, before they take these five vows. That they're supposed to remain in equanimity all the time, 24/7. And everything, anyway, so now the time for question and answer.
We only have a couple minutes, but are there questions?
I have a question. When you come together as a body, as a group of Jains, do you have what I would call celebrations or services, or how do you participate together in your practices?
We have several different. But there are different, I didn't go into different traditions of Jains. Mm. So there is similar to, you know, every other religion, there is, you know, branches. And we have what we call people who do image worshipping. You know, like if you come to our temple, there are images, marble images of certain Shankaras, and they will do worship. So they have their rituals that they carry out. So when they get together, they do the different rituals of prayers and pujas of the Tirthankara, you know, image. Then there are the which I belong to, which we don't believe in images and we don't believe in worshipping images. And so we come together to do, of course, swadhyay, the reading of scriptures together. Our munis or sadhus will give sermons, and we sit down and listen to them. We do joint samayik, where we together and do meditation. And then, of course, every daily we would do what we call patikaman, which is reciting of sutras to remember all of the sins you have committed during the day and ask for forgiveness. You're supposed to actually recognize that you have committed a sin or committed a not acceptable, you know, activity, and immediately ask for forgiveness, which of course does not happen. So at least end of the day, you sit down. If you can't do it at the end of the day, you do it once a week. If you can't do it once a week, we are very, you know, liberal in that sense. You can't do once a week. You do it every fortnight. If you don't do it every fortnight, do once a month. If you don't do it that, at least do once in a year. And that is one of our bigger days. Everybody gets together and does, you know,
confession,
penance for entire year, and say, ask for forgiveness. Now remember, there is a tradition. I mean, there is just a ritualistic asking for forgiveness, and there is a true forgiveness that comes from your heart. True forgiveness in the heart means you will not do it again. Ritualistic, you say, michami dukram, michami dukram, michami dukram, and ask for your forgiveness, and then right after that, you know, you were really bad yesterday. Now everything is lost after that. But that's the practical life versus, you know, those who get spiritually advanced will, like my mother used to do, five samayiks a day in the morning, three in the afternoon, and, you know, 3 hours in the afternoon, 5 hours in the morning, and like 2 hours in night before, you know, sleep. Mm-hmm. but she was very spiritually advanced. One of the things that I say is Jainism teaches you a way of life, because it is a way of life to get liberation. But it also teaches you way of changing bodies or way of dying. The way you want to die is in absolute equanimity state and controlling your own death. My mother, for last 90, she was 93, well, since after 90, she kept on asking our guru, the Muni, when are you going to help me with what we call samadhi maran, you know, equanimous death? When is my time? And he kept saying, it's not your time yet. Keep doing your spiritual practice. I will tell you when to come to India, because he wanted to go to India and do it there. In 2018, early 2018, he told my sister, bring your mother home. So we took her back to, because my sister lives in Bakersfield. Other one was in San Ramon, as her son lives there. And I'm here, so the three children are here. So they told us, bring her home. So we took her to India, and she stayed there. But he kept telling her from January through September, you know, that it's not time yet. In July, he because monsoon season, they stayed one place. They were in Rajkot. That's where we took her. And my sister is also a sadhvi. She has taken her vows 25 years ago. She was there also in Rajkot with our guru. And they kept on practicing spirituality every day until she got sick, and I took her to hospital. When they told me that you are going to have to put machines for breathing machine. I said, absolutely not. He says, no, but we have to. I said, nothing doing. Give me the paper. I sign it. I release you from all. I'm going to take her home now. Our guru told me, bring her to our religious place. We took her there. All the sadhvis were there, and he was there. And he told my mother, I'll come in the morning. It is night now. I can't give you final vows now. I'll give you in the morning. Keep doing the morning he came. She was very much alive, very much did her own, you know, pratikaman in the morning, reciting along with everyone else. And he came, gave her the final vows. And absolutely peaceful way, she left as he was reciting mantras. You know, final, he opened her mouth, final, and he said, Dhammam Saranam Pavajjami. Like, you know, similar to what you have. And peacefully left. This is his way of dying. It's your control, in your hand. Though the length of your life is determined prior to, but you, how you die, without worrying about everything, without having attachment. She wasn't asking, where is my daughter, where is my grandchildren, where are they? None of that, nothing to do. She said, I'm ready to go. It's time for me to change the bodies. And she left spiritually. We did, of course, for her. In India, we do not keep bodies for, you know, more than a few hours, except if night in the morning. But because she had taken the final vows, they actually carry the body in a carriage, and a palki, as we call it, which was to be done. And I said, can we wait till tomorrow? Because my wife and my son and my sister were already on the way, because when they heard she's sick, they decided to fly immediately. And I knew, but they did not make it. He said, yeah, it's you. Sansari, you know, you people living, you decide what you want to do. So he says, I'll keep. We kept her body for 30 hours before cremation, in a sitting position, and not a single degradation of the body. No smell, no nothing, no embalming, nothing. No ice, nothing. Just sitting there in the, you know, final vows. Of course, everybody was coming for darshan, because he had taken the final vows of be detached from everything, including my own body. That's what we call sankhara. He's doing saying, at this stage, now nothing belongs to me. Even this body doesn't belong to me. I discard it. So that's the spiritual. So anyway, Jainism teaches, and we wish every single day, my ultimate death needs to be that way. I die with peace. Because we die, we're not dying anyway. Right? We're taking birth again. So it's not a death. Unfortunately, we don't have the word for it. So we use the word death. It's just leaving the body and readapting the body immediately somewhere else.